About to hear a conversation with Garrett Kaiser. He writes for many journals, including Harper's Magazine, when I first read his work. He's a Guggenheim Fellow who's written a number of books, including the book we're talking about today, The Unwanted Sound of Everything We Want, a book about noise. And Garrett Kaiser, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me on.
So this is really interesting. I because there's so many places you could take a conversation about sound and noise, and you've taken it in a number of interesting directions in your book. But you begin it really about even defining what we mean by the word noise, because noise is a very complex term.
Yes.
Talk a bit about that.
As soon as you call something a noise as opposed to just a sound, you're really making a statement not only about that sound, but about your own humanity, because there's a subjective element involved in calling something a noise. Having read my book, you will know that I'm hell on wheels with anyone who wants to suggest that noise pollution is all in your head or all subjective.
Right.
If noise is a sound, and sound is a measurable phenomenon, it's not subjective in one bit. Neither are some of the health effects that can be caused by noise. Nevertheless, there is always some kind of subjective, or often some kind of subjective judgment made when one sound is designated a noise and another sound isn't. And that's what makes defining it a dicey proposition. I prefer to define noise as any sound that interferes with our full enjoyment of our communities, our homes, our social interactions, our places, our bodies, our time.
But noise, one of the things I took from the arguments and discussions you make in the book is that it also depends on who defines the noise.
Absolutely. It can depend on who is defining the noise. Each of us, of course, defines noise for him or herself, but there are some people who are able to define noise and impose noise or silence on other people because they have the power to do so. And while this may not be the most interesting or most fruitful way to talk about human history, one way to look at human history is in terms of who had the custodianship of what was noise and what was silence. And when other people had to either bear the noise of their so-called betters or be quiet in the presence of their so-called betters.
But in some ways, some really interesting juxtapositions here that I thought about as I was concluding some of your book. And one has to do with if you are of means, of wealth, great wealth, you can better afford a noiseless environment, A. B, that one of the things we always associate with noise is the noise from under, that the poorer, the more working class the community, the noisier it is. And the noisier they are is a perception. And that those contradiction there.
Yes. And I would add to wealth not only the means to live in a more noiseless place, or if you're in the mood, you know, you can pay $200 a ticket to be in a very noisy place, but you have that choice. And not only that, you have the choice to indulge in certain activities that are quiet for you, but noisy for other people. I've never flown business class, but I imagine the business class cabin of a jetliner is fairly quiet and pleasant. Maybe you hear the ice cubes clinking on the glass and a low hum, but for people on the ground, it's much noisier. And yes, we've had the perception, and it continues to this day, that those living in what we might call underclass communities are noisier. And sometimes those communities are noisier. But they are noisier for a variety of reasons, and not just the common reason, the multicultural, mythological reason that them folks just like it louder. For one thing, if you're living in poverty or you're living at the margins or you are living a life that is not fully franchised, fully nourished, you often have to make noise in order to get heard. You're also more likely to work at noisy occupations that damage your hearing and make it obligatory for you to be loud just to hear yourself. You're also more likely to live near noisy transportation routes. You're also more likely to live in dwellings that where you're packed more closely together, where you have poorer construction for those dwellings. And then add to all that the stresses that have to do with doing without, which can create noise also.
So that's what I mean when I thought about the way you address the issue of noise in terms of it's polluting our ear, our very ears and our senses. You also see noise as this kind of political question that you're raising here, which I find a really interesting way to kind of approach this book. It's almost as if you decided to take noise and look at it from actually two different roads and see if they meet.
Yes, you could say that, or several different roads.
Several different roads,
see,
yeah.
And to see where they meet, and also trying to remember in each of those cases that we as a species are for the most part on all of those roads in one way or another, and we're traveling them together. And one of the things I certainly hoped would result from my study for most readers is a sense of their common humanity.
And actually, historically, I mean, the idea of noise has its roots are ancient, and they're both in our ancient, as you talk about the Romans and the Greeks, in our ancient beginnings of urbanization, as well as that meeting the Industrial Revolution is where noise becomes has kind of grown in volume, so to speak, over the years.
Yes, and that, you know, relates to the emphases in my book that you're acknowledging, much to my satisfaction, on the political aspects of noise, because, you know, the word political comes from a Greek word polis for
right.
The city. And politics and the city and noise, as I say in the book, sort of all grew up on the same block. I'm not saying that the concept of noise begins with the city. I think the concept of noise probably is as old as a human or a pre-human's attempt to get to sleep at night and not be able to because of noise. But noise in the way that you and I are most likely to talk about it and consider it as an issue dates, from the beginnings of urbanization, as do many of our political questions, because the phenomenon of urbanization brought with it other phenomena like the stratification of wealth and the way labor was divided, the way that gender was defined, and all of those things. And in the midst of all that activity arose a great clamor of metal instruments, wheels, weapons of war, bodies being tortured, and so on and so forth. It's no accident, but it is certainly a curiosity that the text that's often credited with being the oldest book in the world, the Epic of Gilgamesh, contains a story in which the gods decide to flood human beings, to destroy humankind, because they are being too noisy. And I read that as a projection of an annoyance that probably many ancient Sumerian apartment dwellers were feeling. But I think also, if we want to credit ancient peoples with being at least on a par with our own intelligence, and I do wish to credit them in that way, I think that when they talked about noise, they were also talking about the things that made noise, including human exploitation and cruelty.
And so if they go hand in hand, it's almost impossible to think about a noiseless world, but it is part of the struggle.
It's probably impossible to think of a noiseless world, and I would go further than that and say it's undesirable to some extent. I, for one, do not see silence as the goal, but rather a diversity of sounds and some choices between noise and silence. You know, many of the folks I know have enjoyed both going to rock concerts and going to monasteries and retreat centers, and I think that a healthy society allows us to do both, but gives everybody an opportunity to do both. I think that every society, even one that I can imagine as the best of all possible worlds, is going to contain certain sounds that people don't want. However, there's something to be said for those sounds. First of all, some of the sounds that you don't want come from things that you don't want even more. In other words, if a leopard is after me, I don't want it to be silent. I want it to growl. And so noise, like pain, we want a world in which there's a minimum of pain, or I want such a world anyway, a minimum of pain and suffering. But I would not want someone to be able to make me so that I could feel no pain, which would mean that I'd be constantly sticking my hand into fires and into vices and not knowing I should pull my hand out. The other thing is that noise is often associated with unfamiliar sounds and new sounds. And sometimes out of what we first hear as noise, like, what the heck is that? You know, a mom hearing her kid play rock and roll for the first time, and then maybe discovering there are certain songs by Jimi Hendrix that she actually likes. And so it's probably good for us that there are some acoustical phenomenon that cannot be neatly engineered and controlled by us. But that's a long way from, you know, talking about people who are forced to live under the flight paths of supersonic jets.
We're going to go to a very brief break. We're talking with Garrett Kaiser,
author of the book The Unwanted Sound of Everything We Want, a book about noise. And we'll be right back with more of this conversation in just a minute. On our way to break, we're hearing Boogie in My Bones by Laurel Aitken, known as the godfather of ska. Aitken died on this day in 2005. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information, www.mecu.com.
I've got the boogie in my bones. What a feel so good. I've got the boogie.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and that's 1970 by the Stooges, because Roy Ashton of the Stooges was born on this day in 1948. And we continue our conversation this hour with Garrett Kaiser, author of the book The Unwanted Sound of Everything We Want, a book about noise.
One of the points I think that the subtext and conversations in your book have to do with is that when you look at, like, say, noise and social health, that noise affects what you call the disenfranchised, or the weaker, people who that you can ignore, prisoners, children, anybody without power is affected by noise to a greater degree that they cannot control than others.
Yes, and as I say in the book, we dismiss the issue in much the same way as we dismiss the people most affected by it. We dismiss noise, which I'd be the first to admit is not the most important issue in the world.
Which you say right at the front.
I think is
right.
An important issue in the world. And we dismiss that issue, and we dismiss the people who are affected by it, people you've just named, children, prisoners, young people in the military, factory workers, on and on. And in that, in those very dismissals of what we regard as weak, we see, I think, the causes of many of those problems that we would call strong. In other words, we dismiss the small community, we dismiss the small creature. Who cares if a couple of fish and frogs go extinct? Who cares if a couple of people don't have a place to sleep? Who cares if a couple of kids are crying in the night? You know, let them watch a video or whatever. Shut them up. Give them medicine. And in those dismissals, then, we end up with things like global climate change and fractured community and war over water and all of that stuff because of a kind of haughty arrogance in regard to anything we regard as fragile and small and therefore beneath us.
You have an interesting piece in this book when you talk about noise in prisons. And you talk about a man whose name I should have written down, but I'm blocking him, but I can find him in 2 seconds, who went to jail over his demonstrations against the School of the Americas and what he experienced in prison in terms of noise, where people like Abdul Rahman Zaitoun, who was arrested in New Orleans, you talk about their understanding of noise and how that noise is also affected by how we use noise against people who we arrest on purpose.
Yes, and noise has been used as a form of, it's been used as an interrogation technique. It's probably being used in the Middle East right now as an interrogation technique. It's certainly been used historically. The Russians used it in the Gulag. And in prisons sometimes, and that was the experience of the young man you mentioned, people are punished by being, put in especially noisy shops or being made to spend the night next to especially noisy equipment. Noise becomes part of the process of dehumanization. And that's interesting to me because, two things that sort of influenced, many things influenced my thinking when I was writing this book, but two things that stand out in regard to the question you've just asked me are, one, doing some research into torture and to torture techniques and the way that the torturer tries to make even familiar domestic objects hateful to someone. Doorknobs and bathtubs and refrigerators are used in all kinds of ingenious and grisly ways so that a person's familiar world totally breaks down. And the second thing related to that is that many people who live with noise all around them, they live next door to a loud bar or they live next door to neighbors who fight or play loud music all the time, will describe the experience as one of torture. And if you want to add a third dimension to that, there's a guy at Cornell named Gary Evans who's been doing research on the health and psychology of children exposed to noise in their homes and in schools. And one of the things he's observed and others have observed, too, among children exposed to noise is a phenomenon which you find with abused animals and tortured prisoners, which is called learned helplessness syndrome, the idea that there's nothing you can do about it. So that an animal that's been abused won't even leave its cage when it's unlocked, and sometimes prisoners won't either. There's the idea that there's nothing you can do about this, which I think adds another political dimension to the issue of noise, because I think that some of the powers that be would very much like people to think that this is what it is, this is the menu, there is nothing you can do to alter it. And I think that in some ways the noise of our society tends to reinforce a phenomenon that's being reinforced in other ways by those who hold the reins and who hold the money pouch.
And when you say that, you talk about the organizations in Amsterdam and New York that, like Juliana Bernard Rice and what she did at the turn of the century, we can talk about that a minute, and her battles, the battles that take place in Amsterdam, and you talk about, what's his name, Wolpert? Does it have that name right?
I'm not sure.
Woodenberg, who's the head of municipal services.
Oh, Lansing. Yes.
And people there and the work they do in their organizations to combat noise, the battle of noise. So tie it into what you were just saying. I mean, because do you see this as kind of a conscious move on the part of people in power to emit more noise, or it's a byproduct of the system we created, and these folks are kind of standing up to saying we have to control it somehow?
I think that the literal noise, the noise that, you know, comes out of airplanes and factories and that affects some people more than it affects others, is simply a byproduct of the way we distribute all amenities and that, you know, it's not a deliberate. I think I'd be a little close to paranoid if I said that I thought, you know, rich people were deliberately flying their planes
right.
over the... However, if you define noise as it's sometimes defined as anything that interferes with a signal, if you take noise and extend it beyond noise pollution and purely acoustical phenomena, and you speak of the noise that's used in advertisement, the noise that's used in certain media outlets. In other words, if you speak of noise in a more metaphorical way, in that sense, I do believe that there's a conscious attempt to use the noise of distraction, the noise of diatribe, in order to obscure other issues. So let's get everybody all worked up over whether there's going to be a mosque on the 9/11 site, and maybe they'll spend a little less time being worked up about the kid who just came home on the bus with no legs and no arms from Afghanistan. So I think in that way, noise is a phenomenon that I write about in my book, and something we hear with our ears, but it also bodies forth. It also can serve as a metaphor or a symbol for other things that behave like noise and can be used. And I think the operative expression is drown out. We speak of a noise as drowning out a lesser sound. And certain forms of communication, so-called, can be used as noise to drown out, to jam the signal, to keep certain things from getting through that we don't want to get through to people. So if we can just keep everybody talking and everybody blabbering, and of course here I am on your show blabbering away myself, but
that's
if
we do,
can do that to a certain extent, then maybe no one will notice certain things. No one will notice the money being taken off the table and put into somebody else's pocket.
You have a lot of great lines in here, but to kind of tack on to what you're just describing right now. And by the way, folks, if you're tuning in now, we're listening to Garrett. We're talking to Garrett Kaiser. His book is The Unwanted Sound of Everything We Want, a book about noise. And you have this great sentence in here, and I can read the whole paragraph, but I won't at the moment. But you say, you write, to have a good ear for noise, you need a good eye for silliness. You also need a heightened awareness of pain, because noise is often painful, because much of politics revolves around pains, uses, abuses, and abolition. And the idea that to have a good ear for noise, you need a good eye for silliness, kind of tags on to what you were just describing to me.
Yeah, and you need an ability, you know, to listen under the surface, because if you listen to a noise and think about it, it will almost always lead you to other places. Now, if you want, I can give two examples
please.
Of that, but I don't want to. Is that all right?
Yeah, please do.
One, for instance, there's been a lot of controversy over mechanized lawn equipment, and especially leaf blowers, which are noisy, loud, obnoxious things. And if you're especially in a suburban neighborhood and you've got six of them going, you've got a lot of noise, and that creates annoyance, and people have complained, and people have tried to get ordinances against them, and some Hispanic gardener associations have said, you know, that this is racially motivated, and I'm not so sure that it isn't racially motivated, frankly, although the noise is a factor. But if you can get beyond that and listen, it also has to do with the size of people's lawns. It has to do with the kind of lifestyle that allows one to own a big lawn, but leaves one with little time to maintain the lawn oneself, and then one becomes unfit and has to go to a gym. It has to do with the wages that gardeners, Hispanic and otherwise, make, and how many lawns they have to clean and cut and maintain in order to make a living wage. So if you don't like the sound of leaf blowers, do you like the sound of a rake, and are you willing to pay for someone to be able to use that rake or to rake yourself? And there is that question lying underneath the surface annoyance. Example number two, when this book first came out, I got a call from a nice fella living in another part of the state of Vermont where they're going to bring in some pretty heavy-duty military planes for Vermont Air National Guard. And the people in this community, which tends to be, by Vermont standards, a pretty well-off community, are going to be in the flight path, and they're annoyed with this, and they don't want this to happen, and they have every right to be annoyed with this, and they have every right to not want it to happen. And I am against the idea that anybody's got to come up with a solution for all of the world's problems in order to address any particular problem in their own home and community. So, like, you've got to write education legislation before you have a right to go to school and complain to your kid's teacher. Nevertheless, as I said to this man, if you don't like planes flying over your house, doesn't that obligate you and the others in your community to think about the other houses that these planes fly over, including some that can look to see bombs coming out from under the wings? In other words, okay, you don't like this sound. It is not okay here. Where is it okay? And to what extent is some of the quiet you enjoy based on your willingness to impose noise on other people? And a lot of the noise, quiet discussions we have, if we have them intelligently and with patience and with courage, will lead us to those larger questions. Certainly noise is not the only thing that does that, but it's one of the things that do that.
Picking up here, one of the things that you write about, which I found really interesting, that if you had to cast a vote for one of the most important things contributing to the heightening of noise, your vote goes for the electric light.
Yeah, and I think I would stand by that statement. Although there are certainly many different contenders for, you know, the single invention that made the world noisier. But certainly the electric light contributed to the extension of noisy activities into the darkness, and the extension of those activities that make noise into the darkness, and the colonization of the darkness, so other things that are done in dark, like family time and lovemaking time and meditation time and sleep time, are colonized or just completely done away with. One of the things I love about noise is the way it ties together disciplines. You know, we're talking about technology, we're talking about history, but we're also talking about physiology, because the ear is made in such a way that it recovers sometimes from temporary hearing loss. When the hairs, the little hairs in the inner ear are bent down, if they're not broken, which they can sometimes be by prolonged exposure to loud sound, but if they're bent down and you get a rest, the hearing, they will straighten up and your hearing will return. Most people have gone to a loud concert or a loud dance. You know, they have the experience of being slightly deafened after it's over, but mm-hmm. then in time, you get your hearing back. However, if you are exposed to that noise continuously, and lack that rest, then permanent hearing loss can result. And in fact, right now, something like 1 in 8 American kids has a noise-induced hearing loss. The electric light enabled us to do things like working 3 shifts, like staying up all night, just the way the cell phone and the computer and all those other very wonderful inventions have liberated us from all kinds of drudgery in order to enable us to work 24/7. In that same way, the ability to have rest, to have silence, to have night, disappeared. And with, I think, some wonderful consequences. I like going out at night. I like seeing the city all lit up. But with some real disadvantages as well that we could control. They're not out of our control, but we speak of them as if they are, which is one thing we have in common with our ancestors that I find very interesting. You know, primitive people are supposedly fatalistic. You know, they believe that your fate is written in the stars, and if the gods are angry or you say the wrong word, that this is going to happen to you. We're not much different than they are, except we believe in things like the unstoppable march of progress and the rules of the marketplace, as if these things weren't human inventions, as if we had no control over them, and as if they basically did what they did, and we, in keeping with the idea of learned helplessness, had nothing else we could do except lay down and die, but certainly not get to sleep because it's too noisy to do it.
It's interesting, though, when we think about the electric light. What I was thinking about was when you write in your book about wind turbine noise, that section in your book about that, which we can talk about in a second here. But in terms of also the other side of electricity may be doing for us in the future, that the idea of solar power, the idea of electric cars or of hybrid cars could actually reduce the noise that we are faced with.
Absolutely. And I hope that in fact that happens, not only because I'd like to see less noise, but because a lot of the noise of our civilization is tied to carbon emissions. And so if you do reduce carbon emissions, you're probably going to reduce noise and vice versa. So I'd like to see it happen for that reason. In other words, I'd like to see my great-grandchildren have a habitable planet. But I also like to see it happen because I think it would reverse some of that thinking that I was talking about before, that kind of fatalistic thinking that says, well, you know, noise is a byproduct of progress. We want to have progress. We don't all want to live in caves. And therefore, upward and onward, let's put in the earplugs. And then we come up with a way of making quieter machines, quieter technology, of reducing our carbon footprint, and it might serve to make us ask, well, are there any other things that we consider inevitable, natural, unredeemable, that in fact might be changed for the better? And I don't mean to sound Pollyanna-ish about that, but I do think that there is authentic progress to be made, and progress that consists of more than just bigger and better and louder and fancier and more environmentally destructive.
I mean, it can happen. On my way to talk with you, I got a call from my wife, Valerie, who couldn't get our lawnmower started. It finished what I didn't finish yesterday because of the rain. And she was saying, it's just not working. We should get rid of this lawnmower. I said, yeah, we should get rid of the lawnmower because it's just I hate it. And so it sputters and does this stupid thing and emits all this nasty, toxic stuff. And I said, but why don't we wait and get a electric lawnmower, which is quieter, runs on batteries, and it'd be a more pleasant thing. I mean, I think that there's a shift subtly and slowly happening, but it's also for that shift to happen, you have to make noise to make it happen, or it won't happen.
Do you mean the noise like a protest or
yes,
complaint?
Yes, the political noise, the social
yes,
noise.
Yes, and as I say in my book, I think the one noise we could make more of is the noise of protest. And yes, sometimes noise is required to bring about quiet, with all that quiet implies, or that I see it implying, of justice and sustainability. The other side of that is that in a noisy context, a noisy culture, sometimes quiet and silence are effective forms of protest. I mentioned Rosa Parks in the book.
Yes, you do.
When you think of Rosa Parks, and I think it was 1955, spoke in such a quiet voice when she refused to give up her bus seat, and sparked a social revolution. And, you know, in 65, you've got the Beatles drowned out at Shea. In 76, you've got the Who breaking a sound record, and you have all of these noisy phenomena, but who really rocked the world? It was this seamstress on a southern bus speaking in a quiet voice. So, yeah, sometimes we have to make noise to be heard, and sometimes in the midst of noise, quiet, disciplined resistance and refusal, I think, can be the most revolutionary of all.
That's an interesting the context of your book that way. That really caught me, which is why I was so interested in having this conversation. I mean, because we also talk about the efforts in New York to quiet the noise that exists there, but then you compare that to the, as you write about, the noisiest cities on the planet, Delhi and Mumbai. And it's interesting that the noisiest cities on the planet, at least from my experience, anecdotally, and just from the reading, are the cities in the developing worlds: Mexico, Saigon, Delhi, Mexico City. I mean to say, they have the most air and noise pollution of any places on Earth.
Yes, you know, and in some ways, that too is a byproduct of injustices that are sent abroad, of their scramble to pay off debt, of their scramble to have a decent life. And in other cases, maybe their scramble to have a life like ours, even as we are choking to death on the life that is ours.
And so as you write, and part of your book, you can't we can't all grow on this planet to have a standard of living as we have here. Things have to change.
That's right. Nor can we say to people whose standard of living is so far beneath our own, well, we have enough, we're ready to stop, and we would like you to stop as well. I have a little stat that just happens to be in front of my eyes here, that the average American uses 6 times as much energy as the average Mexican, 38 times as much energy as the average Indian, and 531 times the average Ethiopian.
Wow.
So for us to say to these folks, you guys are getting kind of loud, you're sending a lot of carbon into the air, when we continue to consume energy at this kind of a rate, and to make noise as a byproduct of that, is a bit hypocritical, to say the least. There's a line I like, and I'm paraphrasing it and probably not quoting it as precisely as I should, but it's in a book by Bill McKibben called Deep Economy, in which mm-hmm. he said that the world may not be able to sustain every single human being on the planet having a refrigerator, but every village should at least have a refrigerator in which to keep medicines. And that strikes me as a sane statement. You know, or you have the model where some people all have refrigerators and other people have no medicine, no refrigerator, and just live and die miserably.
Yeah, that's a part that comes out of your sustainability and celebration chapter, that when you wrote about that.
That's right, and I'm so glad you pointed to that, as I am at your pointing to some other things that are dear to my heart and I think central to the heart of the book. And that is the notion that somehow when we talk about things like sustainability, and when Garrett Keyser talks about quietness as a way towards sustainability, that what we tend to think, many of us, and I think what we're conditioned to think, is that we're talking about dullness. We're talking about boredom. In other words, if the world is quieter, and if everybody has enough to eat, and if we're living a more just and sustainable lifestyle, we're all just going to die of boredom. There's going to be nothing to do. It's going to be like, you know, like the foyer in a library somewhere, and this is going to be life. Where, in fact, I think that a world where there is more justice will have more to celebrate. A world where people are living more physically, more manageably, more sustainably, will be a world where we'll return to some visceral, local, joyous forms of entertainment, of dance, of song, of drumbeat, but not drumbeat that's being broadcast by a musician who's not even there, but the drumbeat of a drummer that I see and know, and who in fact is a neighbor of mine. And that world will not be quiet. The decibel levels may get somewhat high, especially if he gets wailing on that drum. But I would suggest that if everybody in the community is there celebrating with him, there's no noise. There's sound. If it stays below 85 decibels about, and nobody's hearing gets damaged, it won't be noise. And it won't be noise because who will complain? Because everyone will be included. There's a guy named Les Blomberg who's mentioned in the book. And
yes,
when you were talking before about mowing lawns, he came to mind because he's got something on his organization website. The Noise Pollution Clearinghouse is his organization. And there's something called the Quiet Lawns Initiative, which some of your listeners might want to look into. Les's organization is at www.nonoise.com. And I was thinking of that with the Quiet Lawns Initiative, and now I've lost my train of thought. What were we talking about?
This was going off to talk about a new world that's sustainable. It doesn't have to be a quiet world. It can be an exciting world, is where you started all this.
Yeah, it can be an exciting world because a greater diversity of sounds is heard, and those sounds are heard in a community. And now I got my train of thought.
Good.
Because Les Blomberg has a statement that he likes to say. He advises on a lot of noise disputes, and he often says that behind every noise dispute there's a breakdown in community. That if you look at it, you will find a breakdown in community. What we have now in many communities and locations is a situation where everybody is doing their own thing. Nobody knows everybody else. And, you know, one person's making noise while another person's trying to get to sleep, and where there's no common celebration, no time for everybody to just let their hair down, cut loose, and have a good time. And I would suggest that in a more just and sustainable world, we would have fewer neighborhood noise disputes at odd and sundry times, and more shared, exultant, even ecstatic celebration. But the people who want to sell us all kinds of gizmos don't want us to believe that.
No, they don't. And that's why I thought it was interesting as you wound your way through the book here, and you talk about people like Herb Singleton and others who do actually work in trying to make people accountable for noise. But he's one of the few people from the African-American world that's doing that. At least that's noted. I mean,
yeah,
we pay attention to what
you're saying. Certainly it's what I have observed in noise engineers and that. You know, it tends to be a pretty male, white world with some notable exceptions. And Herb Singleton in Massachusetts is certainly one of them, and an inspiring exception, I might add.
He sounds like a very interesting man. I'd like to interview him for our show one day.
Well, if you ever decide to do that, let me know. I know how you can get in touch.
That'd be perfect. That'd be great. And just a funny aside, as we're talking about noise and what cultures are noisy, I think about in my world is in many ways black, Jewish, and British. And the British side of our family and that sensibility always finds the black and Jewish side of the world much noisier.
Well, you know, there are probably some cultural differences or community differences in regard to people's tolerance for sound. And some have even suggested that cultures that have more of an outdoor culture, particularly in warm climes, have a different sense of what's an acceptable volume for a conversation than, say, people who are, you know, cooped up in a Scandinavian apartment for 10 months of winter. You don't want to shout or play too many drums in a particular situation. And I would say that, you know, two things in regard to that, at least two. First of all, if such differences exist, and I think they do, they remind us to be careful in how we define noise, especially when we're talking about other people's noise, especially when we're doing things like, you know, flying our planes over 10 countries in order to go to South Africa and complain about vuvuzelas, these little plastic horns. We've just spewed decibels and carbon emissions for the past 4,000 miles. But boy, these little horns are just driving us out of our minds. So there's that dimension. But the other dimension is that we can go so far in talking about subjectivity and cultural differences that we forget the common ground of our human bodies. I mean, I don't care what your culture is. All people need to sleep, and all people get sick if they don't sleep. There's a line in my book where I say, you know, go to a biker bar if you want evidence that too loud is a relative concept for various people.
Which you, know?
You
did.
Which I did.
Which you
but
did.
Go to a biker encampment at 3 o'clock in the morning when people are getting asleep and bang a couple garbage can lids together, and you'll discover that noise annoyance is not just the exclusive pet peeve of the bourgeoisie. And you better wear sneakers when you do it. And run.
Yeah, Kaiser, this has been just a pleasure to meet you, at least by phone, and to have a chance to talk to you about your book, The Unwanted Sound of Everything We Want, a book about noise. On our way to break, we're hearing Crimson and Clover by Tommy James and the Shondells. Mike Vail, who played bass for the Shondells, was born on this day in 1949. When we come back, we'll be talking with Bill Berry about his new book, The 1877 Railroad Strike in Baltimore, and hear about a community run coming up in Park Heights next weekend. So stay with us.